Ave podcast listeners, be warned beforehand, this episode of Emperors of Rome describes self-harm and suicide, and in this instance, explores sources that glorify it. In context, it's an interesting episode, but if this impacts your mental health, please be aware and take care of yourself. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXLVII, Portia. Being the daughter of Cato and the wife of Brutus came with certain expectations from the ancient world. Embody her father's principles, be a fine, upstanding Roman woman, and put Rome first above all other things. Portia did this, and was admired for her disposition. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Porcia Catonis, Portia, the daughter of Cato. So if people have heard of Cato the Younger, they'll know that he's involved in the last civil war of the Republic against Julius Caesar. He dies in the 40s BCE. His daughter, Portia, was born around 73 BCE. So We're in the last century of the Republic. And we're winding it down. And her story is an important part of that, both whose daughter she is and who she'll be married to. And her kind of part in mythologizing of the Republican side, I think.
Mm. And just, you know, for a woman in that era, we know quite a lot about her because of who she is. Not just an extension of who she's married to, who she's related to, but the sort of woman that she is.
That's right. And I'd say that the way that she is portrayed, some of which is probably...
Mythologized?
Yeah. I was going to say some of which is probably reliable and some of which is hyperbole.
Yeah.
Fits into the kind of picture that we're also given of Cato and, spoiler, her second husband, Brutus.
Mm.
We do know about her in her own right, but as so often, a lot of our information comes from biographies of those two men.
Yes.
So Plutarch's biographies of Cato the Younger and of Brutus.
Mm.
You can look in the index and see the number of times that Portia's mentioned, and you'll get two or three paragraphs that deal with her out of the whole biography.
Which is a lot for a woman
at
that time.
It is, but it's, yeah, it would be lovely to have one just of her.
Yes.
That's what we're doing.
Okay, so what do we know then about the young Portia?
She's the daughter of Cato and his wife Attilia. She has a brother also called Cato.
So that would make him Cato the even younger.
Indeed.
Good, good.
But her parents divorce when she's fairly young. There's a suggestion that it's because of Attilia's adultery. So Plutarch tells us in The Life of Cato, chapter 24, he first married Attilia, the daughter of Soranus, by whom he had two children. But afterwards he divorced her for unseemly behavior. Though no one had ever suspected him of jealousy or violence towards his wives. What a man.
Oh, so that's Plutarch saying it was her own fault. She had no reason to go and...
I guess so.
And step out.
I guess that's the implication,
but
also that she was divorced for this unseemly behavior seems to suggest adultery, even though Cato, you know, it's not just if she happened to speak to a man, he wouldn't be automatically jealous. So that does imply that she's acting outrageously, I guess. But, you know, as we'll see in a few cases, we have to hang quite a lot on suggestion in knowing about these women, about both Attilia and her daughter.
But Cato is well within his reason to divorce her as far as Roman society and rules and norms go?
Well, we've mentioned many times before how easy divorce is in Roman society and very common amongst Roman elites.
Yes.
We'll see a case today, actually, a little later on, where it can be disapproved of. But I would say that maybe it's a bit different with Cato because his reputation, and Plutarch is buying into this, is as somebody who is very upright and worthy and virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he's trying to maintain that line that Cato wouldn't have done it unless he had good reason. He's not just doing it so he can make a better alliance or, you know, because he's just decided he's bored with her. She made him do it is pretty much what Plutarch's saying.
Yeah.
She forced his hand.
Yeah. But Cato, and as we'll see during this episode, and this isn't an episode on Cato, but still, sidebar.
We will move off him eventually.
Sidebar already. He seems to be very much a Rome first, not family first kind of guy.
Absolutely. And again, it's definitely his reputation and one that is played up. But one that I think if there's anybody you can say that about, it seems to be Cato the Younger.
Okay, so growing up in this household, what can we say about young Portia then? Plutarch would like us to think that she is her father's daughter.
Oh, yes, very much so. That she imbibes his high standard of morality, his Stoic philosophies. Now, nobody anywhere says that she is a Stoic. We know that Cato the Younger is. And that she similarly will not stand for the kind of autocracy that Cato sees in the coming of Caesar.
Yes.
So she stands for those same political values and that same kind of elite good behavior.
So, and sorry, this isn't in here, so if you want to skip over it, what would it mean living in a Stoic household as a young child then?
Well, what it should mean, and again, I'd say that if anyone is living by these standards, it seems to be Cato, that you do have very high standards of kind of policing your own behavior, of setting that high moral standard and living by it, of not giving way to being reactive to situations and therefore acting in haste, of being thoughtful and intentional, not giving way to emotions, I guess, is the famous part of Stoicism.
Mm-hmm.
Bravery is really important. Friendship is important. Not everybody thinks about that, but it is really important to Stoics. So staying true to your values is something that is kind of the Roman version of Stoicism very strongly.
Is frugality?
It can be, and that's the way Cato is often portrayed. If you remember in, I thought this was a wonderful portrayal, actually, in HBO Rome, he wears raggy clothes, doesn't he?
He was a sackcloth kind of guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the way that he has come down to us. So even though the people we know about, people like Cato and later definitely Seneca, often are very, very wealthy, they at least claim that they could live with very little.
Yes. So this is the kind of environment that she's growing up with and the values that we're told that she has. Coming back to the Rome first, not family, what plans does Cato have for Portia?
Well, the first thing we find out about, very typical for Roman sources, is her marriage, which was probably in, I don't know, her mid-teens. It's a political alliance that is made for her. Right? Mm-hmm. Both of her marriages are to people who would align with Cato and his strict political views. So Cato's ally, Marcus Calpurnius Bibulus, is her first husband. Now, if anyone's heard of him before, it's probably because he was consul in 59 BC with Julius Caesar.
During the consulship of Julius and Caesar.
Yeah, he didn't get to do much, according to most of our sources.
Yeah.
He was kind of cowed into being in the background. I can only imagine, actually, that given Portia's later reputation, she would have seen him as maybe even a bit of an embarrassment if he really was that kind of non-consequential. They may have been married as early as 58 BCE, which, if she was born in 73, would have made her about 15. Bibulus was in his mid-40s at the time. None of this is unusual. While she's married to Bibulus, another ally of Cato's, a man called Hortensius, floats the idea of marrying her. So he was suggesting that she divorce Bibulus, marry him, and then, as we'll see from this is quite a lengthy quote from Plutarch, maybe move around again. This is just sort of being passed around allies here, potentially. So this is what Plutarch says in chapter 25 of Cato's life. Quintus Hortensius, a man of splendid reputation and excellent character, so that makes it all okay, desiring to be more than a mere associate and companion of Cato, and in some way or other to bring his whole family and line into community of kinship with him, attempted to persuade Cato, whose daughter Portia was the wife of Bibulus and had borne him two sons, so she is by this point mother of two sons, therefore proven fertile, to give her in turn to him.
Sorry, I should just say that was your aside. That was not the quote.
No, but it gets worse in the actual quote.
Okay.
To give her in turn to him as noble soil for the production of children.
Oh, noble soil.
Yeah.
Oh. This is gross old men talking about somebody who's still a teenager probably at this point.
Yeah, well, probably not much more than 20, certainly.
Oh.
According to the opinion of men, he argued, such a course was absurd. So this is Cato.
Yeah.
Cato says no. Cato doesn't say no for the reasons you might hope for. So Hortensius gives the rationale here. According to the law of nature, it was honourable and good for the state that a woman in the prime of youth and beauty should neither quench her productive power and lie idle, because their only purpose is to bear children, nor yet, by bearing more offspring than enough, burden and impoverish a husband who does not want them. So Bibulus has had two children with her. Surely he doesn't want more. That'll just be expensive. So give it to me for a bit. We'll have some children. Moreover, says Hortensius, community and heirs among worthy men would make virtue abundant and widely diffused in their families, and the state would be closely cemented together by family alliances. So there's all kinds of rhetoric going on here in terms of the usefulness of women and how we bind together these families via women and the offspring that they have. And if Bibulus were wholly devoted to his wife, Hortensius said he would give her back after she'd borne him a child, and he would thus be more closely connected both with Bibulus himself and with Cato by a community of children.
Oh,
Plutarch, what have you told us there?
Oh, bloody hell, I need a shower after that. That's just, I need to wash this Cato off me.
Okay, so there's this idea. I mean, I think in Roman terms, in Hortensius's terms, this builds up how important Portia is. It's very hard for us to see it in those ways. So Cato says no, which from our point of view is points for Cato.
But
there's a big but coming. And the reason he says no, before we get to that, is he considered it absurd for him to propose marriage with a daughter who had been given to another. So instead, he offers up his own wife.
Yeah. This comes to the Rome first thing. Hortensius has made this argument. Cato says, yeah, good point.
It makes the alliance between them maybe not quite the same kind of alliance as Hortensius is after. And actually, according to Plutarch, let me just step back a bit from this. Hortensius changed his tactics after Cato said no, threw off the mask, which suggests maybe this is what he wanted all the time, and boldly asked for the wife of Cato himself, since she was still young enough to bear children and Cato had heirs enough.
So that
anyway,
happens.
Anyway, we don't want to turn this into a Cato podcast, but yeah, that does happen. So it's Portia sidesteps it. All right, so as we can see there, she's had two children with Bibulus. There is a bit of a question over whether Bibulus' elder son, Lucius, was Portia's child or the child of a former marriage, because in 42 BCE, he will fight at Philippi. And would he have been old enough? Because she really couldn't have been married to him before 58.
So, no, that doesn't feel like it.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just a kind of a minor footnote there, that there is someone who fights at Philippi that is sometimes seen as Portia's son, but probably not. Bibulus dies in 48 BCE. This is during the civil war against Caesar. And of course, he is against Caesar, but it's not actually in battle. He, I think I read recently that he seems to have died of the flu. Not quite sure how we know it was that precisely. So the Republican side and Portia have lost Bibulus. So in 45 BCE, which I have to say it's a bit of a gap for a woman to not be married during this time from such an elite family, but I guess there are civil wars going on.
3 years?
So 3 years later, she marries Brutus.
So why is Brutus seen as a good match for her?
Well, is he seen as a good match? Well, he's very much on the Republican side. He's going to confirm that even more the following year. Of course, he's fighting with the Senate against Caesar in the Civil War. He's of an extremely famous, historically famous family. I'm sure we've mentioned before that he claimed descent from the Brutus, who was one of the founders of the Republic, and he put out coins suggesting that. In other ways, was he the greatest match? He was also Portia's cousin. His mother, Servilia, was Cato's half-sister. His mother, Servilia, is also famous for being Julius Caesar's lover. you might remember we've mentioned before that there were rumors that Brutus was Caesar's son, but a bit like Lucius is as son of Portia, it doesn't work out time-wise.
Yes,
so no.
Yeah, yeah.
But Brutus has to divorce his wife, called Claudia, who he's been married to for a long time, in order to marry Portia. Now, I keep saying divorce very easy in Rome, not really controversial. But Cicero seems to imply that there is a bit of argy-bargy, a bit of controversy about this marriage, and that Servilia herself might not have been happy with it. There are hints in some of Cicero's letters, which are contemporary, all right? Not like Plutarch. Plutarch, remember, is writing in the late 1st century CE.
Mm.
He's writing 150 years later. Cicero is writing these letters. Eventually, we'll see a letter he writes to Brutus himself, but mostly to his friend Atticus at the time.
They're gossips, those two.
They are, but it is very... which doesn't mean we have to believe every word at all.
Yeah.
But we're not in different times and different values. It hasn't been turned into some kind of narrative that's been twisted, unless it's deliberately by Cicero.
Mm.
Anyway, we kind of have to read into it to see this enmity of Servilia, I think. But potentially it's there. So Cicero might be saying that the marriage of Portia and Brutus causes a bit of a scandal. So in 45 BCE, in June 45, he writes a letter to Atticus saying, "If Brutus takes any steps, be sure to let me know." So this is during the Civil War, remember? He could be talking about that.
Mm.
But then he goes on, "I think he shouldn't lose any time, especially if he has made a firm decision. He will wipe out or dampen down all the chatter, because people are talking, even to me, about it."
That's really vague.
That could be vague.
Everything from he's fooling around with Portia to he's going to kill Julius Caesar.
And a whole lot of other stuff we don't know about. Anyway, if you want to look it up for yourself, it is Book 13, Letter 103 to Atticus.
Mm.
A month later, he's writing to Atticus again. And Cicero writes that it's very annoying for Brutus that the women in his life aren't getting on, that they're actually enemies to each other, especially when he's so nice to both of them.
Mm.
Now, that's all he says. He mentions no names. This is Book 13, Letter 22.
Yeah.
Commentators talk about how tiresome the women are. It's very annoying. And this is read as Servilia and Portia. What do you think of that? It literally says he's so nice to both of them.
Okay.
Both.
Yeah.
Doesn't say them by name, but I actually don't think it's too far a stretch to think his mother and his wife might be the two important women in his life.
No, I think that that's fair enough, unless it's first wife and side piece.
You're referring to Portia as side piece.
I think I am, and I apologize.
Yeah.
Both to Portia and Brutus.
Even though I think that's potentially a valid way of reading this, I also think that both Cicero and generations of commentators have been very happy to see Servilia as this annoying, meddlesome, difficult character, based on maybe not that much. So, yeah, we don't really know. It's suggestive, but no more than that.
So after the death of Bibulus then, Portia has a busy few years in her life. She has the death of her father in 46.
Mm.
And then at that point, I guess she's free to marry whoever she wants.
Probably, yeah. Unless there's another older male in her family that she's under the patronage of, under the tutelage of. But she's been married, she's a widow, and her father's dead. Usually in those circumstances, you are now a kind of free woman. Very unusually in Roman society to make your own decisions.
Mm.
So yes, it's likely that she chooses to marry Brutus. We don't have details really about that.
But Brutus does divorce his wife to marry Portia.
Mm-hmm.
That insinuates there's some sort of relationship going on. I mean, look, there's a lot of reading the tea leaves to get to this point, I realise.
Yeah. I mean, what it suggests to me, if I were creating the Hollywood drama version of this, unfortunately she's not a character in HBO Rome, she would have been a great character.
She would have been. She would have fit in there really well.
Yeah. But as far as we can tell, she firmly shares his values.
Yeah.
So this is, again, I feel like, you know, for our terms, and we shouldn't put our terms onto this, but it's hard not to. You can see it as a love match, but it seems like they're like-minded politically, rather than swept away by some romantic notion, unless you see the mythification of the Republic, the desire to keep the Republic when it's clearly on its last legs as a kind of romantic ideal. But it's not a hearts and flowers romance. It's more of a, we have a deep belief in this.
So if I can pull a Plutarch quote back into this, he does at various points describe Portia as having an affectionate nature and sensible pride.
And is fond of her husband, he says as well.
There you go.
I'm always very, I know this is boring of me, but very skeptical about using Plutarch. And, you know, he's the best source we've got.
Yeah.
So I should be glad that we've got him at all. But especially in terms of emotions, just given it's 150 years later, he's clearly a big fan of Portia.
Yeah.
And her kind of strong moral code. I mean, he doesn't give us any of the "this marriage was a scandal" stuff. We're pulling that out of trying to read between the lines of Cicero. If she's going to be an ideal woman, then she's got to be a good wife from Plutarch's point of view in Plutarch's time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't want to spoil it, but it may not be as reliable as we'd like.
Did Portia know about the conspiracy that Brutus was caught up with and what he was up to, and even ultimately the role that he'd play in Julius Caesar's assassination?
Well, this brings us to a very extreme story in Plutarch, because Plutarch says she didn't, but she wheedled it out of him. Mm. Well, wheedled is the wrong word. She kind of, we should give a warning. This is a story of self-harm. She harmed herself until he'd tell her. It's pretty extreme, I think. So in Plutarch, Brutus is keeping it secret, and this is the point in the narrative where Plutarch says to us, you know, they didn't tell Cicero about it, the plotters, the conspirators. But Portia, being, as we've said, affectionate, fond of her husband and full of sensible pride, did not try to question her husband about his secrets until she had put herself to the following test. Now, the implication here, which other sources bring out even more strongly, is that she's proving that she can keep a secret. But no one can torture it out of her, I guess. Or she can withstand anything, so she won't tell. So this is what she did. She took a little knife, such as barbers used to cut the fingernails, and after banishing all her attendants from her chamber, she made a deep gash in her thigh, so that there was a copious flow of blood. And after a little while, violent pains and chills and fever followed from the wound. Such an extreme thing to do, especially in a world where you can die from infection. Seeing that Brutus was disturbed and greatly distressed, which
you
I'm
reckon?
At least glad to hear about, in the height of her anguish, she spoke to him thus. Brutus, I am Cato's daughter, and I was brought into your house not like a mere concubine to share your bed and board merely, but to be a partner in your joys and a partner in your troubles. You can see how Plutarch really wants her to be the ideal heroic woman, the woman who will be with you through all of your trials and tribulations. This is the ideal that we saw as well in the Praise of Turia epitaph. Somebody who will be there when you're in trouble. This is what Portia's been set up as. You indeed are faultless as a husband. So Brutus also being seen as perfect. But how can I show you any grateful service if I am to share neither your secret suffering nor the anxiety which craves a loyal confidant? So, you know, the idea is that she's seen through this. She can see he's worried and she wants to know what it is. I know that woman's nature is thought too weak to endure a secret. So put down women. But good rearing and excellent companionship go far towards strengthening the character. And it is my happy lot to be both the daughter of Cato and the wife of Brutus. It's quite hard to read. It's just putting it on here. Before this, I put less confidence in these advantages, but now I know that I am superior even to pain. So she's kind of tested herself and won, is the idea. That she can withstand pain. The only reason she can do it, because women are generally pathetic, is she's been brought up by Cato and now she's married to Brutus, and this makes her strong. Thus, having spoken, she showed him her wound and explained her test. Whereupon Brutus, amazed and lifting his hands to heaven, prayed that he might succeed in his undertaking and thus show himself a worthier husband of Portia. Then he sought to restore his wife to to make her feel better.
Wow.
Yeah. It worked for the Romans, or at least Plutarch's audience. I'm not sure it entirely works for us. But it becomes kind of part of the Portia mythology. So Dio Cassius in the 3rd century is still giving us a version of this.
So she takes one for Rome.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, she's putting her own comfort below, you know, the good of her husband and his reputation, and to try and ease his burden.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like both Plutarch and Dio, who has lines like, "Fear not, tell me all you're concealing. Neither fire nor lashes nor goads will force me to divulge a word. I was not born to that extent, a woman. Hence, if you still distrust me, it's better for me to die than to live. Otherwise, let no one think me longer the daughter of Cato or your wife." All right, so Dio often goes a bit further in that kind of gender divide. This reminds me of what he does with the Boudicca speech, right, where she kind of makes herself manly and actually compares herself to Nero, who she sees as womanly because she's tougher. So he likes these tough women and to build them up as manly, and that's what's going on here. So there's a lot of gender play and confounding gender stereotypes going on through the way that Portia's portrayed. So she gets the plot out of Brutus in this very extreme way.
Okay. So she's brought up to speed, but she doesn't have a role in anything.
No.
Okay.
Dio says she's the only woman who knows about it, but no woman has a part in it. You know, it's in the Senate. It's a place they're excluded from.
So Brutus is involved in the assassination of Caesar in 44 BCE. And then there is another protracted civil war, and he will die in Philippi in 42.
Mm-hmm.
So another couple of years later. So what do we know about Portia during this time? We know how she ends her life. We're told how she ends her life. We're told how people think and doubt how she ended her life. And there's also a question mark over when it happened.
Mm-hmm. But it is the next thing we know about her.
Mm.
All right, she proves she's worthy of Brutus, and then the next thing we know, she's dying.
Yes.
We don't get anything in between, unfortunately.
But much like her test of her fortitude, it's very much taking one for Rome, almost.
Yeah, I mean, we can imagine during this time, if she is anything like the woman she's portrayed as, she's advocating for Brutus. She's supporting him. She does have two sons as well, who she's going to leave behind.
But she's her father's daughter to the very end.
Yeah, Cato's killed himself in 46.
Yeah.
Her husband has been involved in the successful assassination of Caesar, but then been driven out of Rome and will lose in the subsequent civil war against Mark Antony and Octavian. Whether she's there for that? We don't know. She might have already died at that point, maybe in despair at her husband going away.
Sorry, by there for that, you don't mean that she's in Philippi, but
no,
whether she's still alive.
Whether she's still alive in 42.
Yeah.
All right, so we get lots of details about how she may have ended her life. It's confusing to us when this happened. The sources are conflicting, basically. If we're going still with Plutarch, then her death is almost the very last part of Cato the Younger's life. It's interesting that Portia, who we know of largely through these two biographies, she kind of comes at the end of both of them.
Mm.
It's almost like she's a really significant part of Cato's legacy, Cato the Younger's, and also of her husband's. Cato's son, Cato the...
Even younger.
The youngerer. dies at Philippi, along with Brutus. But I feel like Portia's even more significant for those who kind of talk about this legacy.
Mm.
Anyway, let's get to the quote. "End of Cato the Younger's Life" by Plutarch. "And it is still more true that the daughter of Cato was deficient neither in prudence nor courage." And he uses the word that actually means manliness in Greek, Andrea. "She was the wife of the Brutus who killed Caesar. She knew about the conspiracy and gave up her life in a manner worthy of her noble birth and her lofty character, as is told in the life of Brutus." I like that. It's like, go look at my other work.
Yeah, see my other work.
Just a bit of cross-listing here. So then we do go over to the life of Brutus, but here, this is where the contradictions start. This is the very end, the very last chapter of Brutus's life. As I say, there's one more little bit in the life of Cato after that, a few more sentences, but in Brutus's life, Brutus has died, and then we get this. As for Portia, the wife of Brutus, Nicolaus the philosopher, so Plutarch's saying, I'm quoting someone else.
He's putting in a reference.
Yeah, as well as Valerius Maximus.
Bit more, yeah, okay.
All right, so whose work we have, relates that she now desired to die because her husband Brutus is dead.
Okay.
Right, he's died at Philippi. She was opposed by all her friends who kept strict watch upon her. So she snatched up live coals from the fire, swallowed them, kept her mouth fast closed, and thus made away with herself. What a hideous way to die.
Yeah.
But look, I have to say, this is part of a trend of what we see in these, oh, look at this very heroic woman, that people try and stop them killing themselves, and then they will find some extreme way to do it. I think this is the most extreme one of all the ones I've seen.
Yeah.
And yet there is extant a letter of Brutus to his friends in which he chides them with regard to Portia and laments her fate because she was neglected by them and therefore driven by illness to prefer death to life.
Okay, so even Plutarch is saying, look, I'm not sure of the chronology here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. The story doesn't make sense because he says there's a letter from Brutus that talks about her death, whereas the Nicolaus and Valerius Maximus narrative is that she kills herself in response to his death.
Yes.
So which way round it is. And you can imagine that part of the making Portia heroic might have been that she despairs when Brutus is dead. But the letter, which we don't have, suggests that she's despairing because she's not being supported by her friends, and that she becomes ill and decides to kill herself. So Plutarch says, it would seem then that Nicolaus was mistaken in the time of her death, since her distemper, sort of low mood, her love for Brutus and the manner of her death are also indicated in the letter, if indeed it is a genuine one. So at the end he says, oh, maybe that's not genuine, the letter by Brutus. So he doesn't know one way or the other. That's the Life of Brutus, chapter 53.
But he doesn't also, you know, put any doubt on the coal swallowing.
No, no. I mean, he reports that, doesn't he?
He's just not sure of the chronology.
Like, this is the only version we have of her death, and it becomes the version that gets repeated of how she does it. But it's part and parcel of that over heroicizing, over courageous woman who will wound herself to prove that she can be trusted with secrets. It's like, what's the most extreme manner of death we can give her? It may be in line with that. If we talk about the chronology, something perhaps more reliable that suggests that Portia has died before Brutus is a letter from Cicero to Brutus. This is to Brutus, letter 1-9, saying, you have indeed suffered a blow. The like of what you have lost was nowhere on earth. And you must grieve in so heavy a calamity. To lack all sense of grief might be more pitiable than grief itself. But moderation in grief, which is expedient for other men, is for you a necessity. So,
pull yourself together quickly.
Well, he's saying, I guess you're still going off to fight a war. So you have to be moderate. And to be fair to Cicero, he does say a little earlier in that letter, you know, you were there for me in my grief, which is almost certainly when his daughter Tullia died, when he was utterly bereft. Now, again, Portia's name isn't mentioned, unfortunately.
Yeah, and none of the circumstances are mentioned. So, I mean, the grief could be anything. Grief could be, you know, he's all conflicted about having just killed Julius Caesar, you know?
Cicero's letter seems to be dated to June 43 BCE, the year before Philippi. And that's what gives us the usual date for Portia's death as 43. And we know that because Cicero says he's going to give the letter to somebody called Vettus, who seems to have left Rome around that time.
By the courier's timetable, we know when Portia died.
Well, this is according to Shackleton Bailey, who,
it's
the great authority on Cicero.
It's good. A takes you to B, takes you to C, takes you to F, but sure.
But whether it is actually about Portia's death, again, we have to slightly read between the lines.
Yeah.
Anyway, her death as a response to Brutus's becomes the most common narrative telling. So we get it in Cassius Dio, we get it in Valerius Maximus, we get it in Appian.
Yes.
And it is always a death by suicide and after she hears about Brutus's defeat at the Battle of Philippi.
Is it always the coals?
Yes. So Appian, who's fairly close in time, Bellum Cavillae, Civil War, Book 4, 136. Portia, the wife of Brutus and sister of the younger Cato, when she learnt that both had died in the manner described, although very strictly watched by domestics, seized some hot embers that they were carrying on a brazier and swallowed them.
Mm.
Valerius Maximus, who's mentioned by Plutarch, says, he's a little flowery with it, "All ages will also with due admiration revere your chaste fires, O Portia, daughter
chaste
of..."
Chaste fires. That's poor.
"Daughter of Marcus Cato. When you learnt that your husband Brutus was defeated and slain at the Battle of Philippi, not having a weapon at hand, you swallowed burning coals. Your feminine soul imitated the masculine death..." They love this, don't they? Masculinizing her. "The masculine death of your father. And perhaps your death was braver because he chose a common method, but you chose a novel method of dying."
Wow.
"So you gave me a good story. I love it," says Valerius Maximus.
I mean, man, I can hear Elton John singing that. That's like one sentence away from Candle in the Wind.
Now, surely he would have gone for the poetic version, because Valerius Maximus was writing prose.
Yeah.
And that we get around the same time, maybe slightly later, in Martial, in an epigram. Epigram, book one, epigram 42. "When Portia had heard the fate of her consort Brutus..." It's an old translation of her husband, Brutus. "And her grief was seeking the weapon, which had been carefully removed from her. 'You know not yet,' she cried, 'the death cannot be denied. I had supposed that my father had taught you this lesson by his fate.' She spoke, and with eager mouth swallowed the blazing coals. 'Go now, officious attendants, and refuse me a sword if you will.'"
Mm.
I doubt she could say that thing about the sword after swallowing blazing coals.
Yeah, no, I don't think she'd say much of anything.
No.
All right, so...
Hard to know what to say, isn't it, Matt?
It's really hard to know what to say. So what can we take then from the life and the story of Portia and the way that she lived and what it meant to be a Roman woman?
She's been mythologized as this, I guess, female ultra-stoic.
Mm.
And all the sources about her suggest that she's exceptional. So this is not what you would get with a normal wife. But look, this is what you could have if you'd married someone who'd been brought up by Cato. That's what our sources talk about. And in as much as she gets invoked these days, she's kind of the subject of quite a few paintings, which tend to put the extreme elements that we've talked about today. They depict either the stabbing of the thigh or the picking up of the coals. So those two stories of self-harm, so suggesting that these are admirable. So I think in terms of the Roman sources, they're telling us that a woman can be manly and courageous, but it's exceptional. And when she gets invoked later, it's showing us those moments where she's acting in this really extreme way. And I guess she's been called a stoic superwoman. I mean, I think it's potentially quite dangerous, this idea that self-harm is something to be admired.
Mm.
You could say that the way a lot of Roman men have been treated as well, because suicide is held as a kind of an elite way out of an untenable position. But here it's all the more unexpected because it's a woman.
Yeah, but I think also that, I mean, I'm going to use the word exceptional because it can be read as neither good nor bad.
Mm.
But the Romans clearly thought that that was a bit extreme. Plutarch mentions that her friends essentially put her on suicide watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she is not the normal when it comes to the way that she acts and conveys herself.
I think there's a couple of things to say about that. First of all, for the Romans, Cato could be seen as a bit too extreme, too rigid. He's seen as somebody who might spoil your fun, and Portia is therefore a suitable daughter because she's also so rigid and will stick by her values no matter how much it means that she harms herself. You might not be able to aspire to this, but she's kind of held up there on a plinth, on a pedestal, as the ideal that you might be able to reach if you were this brave.
Mm.
It kind of reinstantiates the gender divide, doesn't it? Men might be this brave, often are. Women rarely are, but look, if you're an exceptional woman, you can be.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other readily available podcatching platform. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. You can also follow us on Blue Sky. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast was recorded at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.